Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
We are limiting the potential for those people in the future, for our own progeny, for our own children and grandchildren. We are limiting their future by overconsuming today.
That's the voice of author, activist, and one of the original founders of Greenpeace, Rex Weiler. We speak to Rex today about our need to decrease our consumption and the recent degrowth movement. Stay tuned.
We seem to live in a society that seems to think of the world as this infinite quarry for exploitation that, you know, eventually turns into a rubbish pit. But, you know, we never think about the fact that we live in that world. Someone who thinks a lot about the world we live in and how to create positive ecological change that is centered around not only humans, but the living systems and ecosystems, is Rex Weiler. He is a writer, journalist, ecologist, and historian, and we're very privileged to have him on our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. So nice to be here with you again.
Thank you. Now, we were talking with economist Robin Hanling. He says, you know, one of the worst things we can do when we try to promote growth is to invest in exploitive industries like gas, exploration, oil. He says, industries that clearly are leading to the destruction of our ecosystem. In Canada, in particular here in BC in the north, we have now a movement that people are calling No Fracking Way. Can you talk a little bit about the impact of fracking to our ecosystem and our way of life?
Fracking is a way to essentially get more hydrocarbons out of the ground by both exploding and forcing chemicals into the ground to literally fracture the rock. Sometimes people think when we drill oil wells or gas wells that there's a big pool of oil or a big container of gas down there, but it's not like that. The gas and oil exists in the rock, in the porous rock, and by fracturing the rock, oil companies can essentially get a bit more oil and gas out of the rock. This technology has been known since about 1947. It's not particularly new technology. The reason we're using it now is because we've already taken all the easy oil and gas out of the ground, where you could just drill a well and it would flow out. So now this is why we're now going deeper into the ocean, higher into the hills, deeper into the mountains, and deeper into the earth, and we're having to explode and fracture the rock to get the oil out, because we've already used up all the cheap, easy-to-get oil. Now, the problems associated with fracking, the main problem is the chemical contamination of the ground, because the chemicals that are going down there, methane, arsenic, acetones, acetic acid, all these kinds of chemicals, benzenes, and so forth, of course, end up contaminating the water tables. And this has come to light in places where they've done this in the United States, for example, in Pennsylvania and Wyoming and Colorado, lawsuits against oil and gas companies who have contaminated the aquifers and the water tables by injecting these chemicals into the ground. So that's probably the biggest concern. There's also cases of methane and other gases in water wells, so people have literally had flammable water coming out of their faucet. In other words, they could, along with the water coming out of the faucet is methane, they can literally ignite the gas coming out of their water faucets. So this is also a problem. There's also air contamination. There are both particulates and chemicals that are released into the air, silica particulates, for example, which are a health hazard, sulfuric acid and benzenes in the air, which are a health hazard. So there's definitely an environmental impact and a human health impact. And, of course, typically the industry as they have always done throughout our history, we can see they rush ahead, they push ahead, they ignore the problems, try to gloss over the problems, and they rush ahead without thinking this through. So it's really left to the citizens once again to raise the issue when they start noticing their water tables are contaminated.
I want to talk a little bit about that, because while we are constantly told, oh, it's safe levels of pollution, we have safe levels of contaminant in the water, we never ask the question, who's giving us these readings and who's telling us it's safe? I mean, we are told there's a safe level of nuclear exposure right now from the accidents in Japan. We are told that there are safe levels of exposure from the chemicals spilled by VP last year on the coast. We're still living with this. What is the long-term impact of this chemicals in our environment, in our air, in our water, and in our food?
One of the reasons that the companies historically have been able to get away with this is because it's extremely difficult to track, say, for example, increased cancer rates, leukemia rates, and so forth in the population as a result of chemical contamination or nuclear radioactive contamination. Because we can't follow a single molecule of a benzene or a single radioactive molecule through the air and into somebody's body, and we can't pinpoint when that radioactive particle or chemical mutated a cell which caused the cancer or the birth defects and so forth. However, what we can do is we can track general trends, and we clearly can see in every region where we have contaminated water tables with chemicals, or where we have contaminated the air with chemicals, or where we have, downwind from the Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown, for example, and the industry always said there were no deaths after the Three Mile Island nuclear meltdown in the 70s. Well, there were deaths. There absolutely were cancer deaths, and you can see them by looking at the cancer rates, the leukemia rates, downwind from Three Mile Island or downwind from Chernobyl, and I guarantee you will see them downwind from Fukushima, where the cancer rates increase. So our ability to track these is really based on statistical measurements of increased cancer rates. And the estimation, for example, at Chernobyl, the number of people who were killed because of the Chernobyl meltdown, the industry says less than 4,000. In fact, the scientific evidence from Eastern Europe and from that exists and has been published, by the way, by the New York Academy of Science, says more like 100,000. So we find that the industry traditionally continually underreports and underestimates the impact of what they're doing. Look, we have a cancer epidemic in our modern culture, and that cancer epidemic is caused by, essentially, it's caused by the pollutants, by the toxins, by the radioactivity that we've injected into our environment. And the companies get away with it because it's very hard if someone comes down with leukemia. If my child or someone's child comes down with leukemia, it's very difficult to prove that that child contracted that particular case of leukemia from that particular chemical which was released by that particular company. But we know darn well that it's true, and we can see it in the general statistics. So it's made it difficult for the public to fight back against denial and the underestimation of the impact by the companies.
There is a lot of talk now of creating sustainable economies. Sustainability seems to have captivated our imagination, and rightly so. But I think there is a clear disequilibrium of those who profit from the status quo, doing business as today, or changing our way from investing in mining or in fracking or exploiting oil resources to creating green jobs, to creating ecologically sensitive kind of development that takes nature into account. What are some of the math? You describe sustainability and justice. You say do the math. What are some of the disequilibrium that we have now? Who pays and who profits? And what can we do to change that?
There's a lot of talk these days about sustainability, but I have to say, Sylvia, it doesn't look to me like most of the people talking about sustainability really know what they're talking about or have bothered to really look very deeply into the question of what sustainability means and what it's going to take. And that, for example, the environmental damage that we have done as of right now on Earth today primarily has fueled the wealth of one segment of society, which is about 15% of the people. So if you look at all the environmental damage, the disappearing of the fish in the seas, the draining of aquifers, the draining of rivers and lakes, the loss of the Aral Sea, and all on and on and on, the contamination and so forth. Essentially, this has fueled a wealthy 15% of the human population. So now we're looking around and seeing that what we're doing is not sustainable, and yet we also hear talk that we're going to develop a sustainable economy, supposedly, that's not only going to keep our current Western wealthy society going, but is somehow going to raise up the consumption standards of the other 85% of the people on the planet. I don't think anybody's actually stopped and done the supply chain calculations and actually figured out where all this stuff is going to come from. So if you look at those numbers, if you look at the consumption of copper and wood products and cement and so forth and so on, and you calculate even a modest increase or growth in the 85% of the world that has been essentially left out of the modern wealth creation of industrialism, and you imagine that we're going to supply even a modest increase in consumption to the rest of the world, the only way to do that is for the wealthy nations to consume less stuff. It's not biologically and physically possible for the Earth to supply the sort of resources to translate the kind of consumption habits in Europe and Canada and North America to the rest of the world without absolutely creating ecological disaster. It would not work. It's not going to happen because the Earth cannot produce those resources. So unless we're willing to actually talk about using less stuff, you know, roughly, if I've done these calculations, roughly I can tell you, if the rich 15% of the world, that's people like us in Canada, people in the United States and Europe, the wealthy 15%. If we reduced our physical and energy consumption by half, that would allow the other 85% of the people in the world to double their consumption, which still would be way below the level of consumption in North America. It would allow the rest of the world to double their consumption, and it would allow us to reduce our environmental overshoot from its current 30 to 50%. Back to zero so that we would be sustainable. But the only way to do that is for the rich countries and the rich consumers in the West to reduce our consumption dramatically. And that's very politically difficult. Nobody in our political system wants to propose something like that.
I heard you once speak about what it would mean if we don't, though, and you used the example of a fly in a bottle. Can you talk about that?
Oh, well, I think I used the example of, the fruit flies in a jar. This is an experiment I did, many people did when we were in high school in biology class, where you put 8 fruit flies in a jar, some 4 male and 4 female, or 4 fruit flies or whatever you start with, and you put a tomato in the jar, and the fruit flies, of course, start consuming the tomato and start multiplying, and pretty soon you have 50 fruit flies, and then you have 100 fruit flies, and then you have 200 fruit flies, and then everything seems to be going along just fine. You've got several hundred fruit flies and got half the tomato left, and then you come back in the next day and then all the fruit flies are dead, the tomato's gone. In other words, if this is an experiment, or this is an example of watching exponential growth, Exponential growth means that something that's growing is growing by some percentage growth. Like we talk about the economy growing at 3%, or we talk about the value of a house going up 10% or 5% a year. This is exponential growth. Now, the problem and the challenge that we face in any biophysical habitat, any environment, any ecosystem, nothing can grow exponentially forever. Nothing. There are no examples, zero examples in nature of any species of any kind ever growing exponentially forever. Growth always stops in nature. As Albert Bartlett says, the physicist at the University of Colorado says, after maturity, all growth is either cancer or obesity. And we have to understand that all growth in nature stops. So the point is, the fruit flies in the jar on the tomato, they can grow and grow and grow and grow and everything is fine until their exponential growth uses up all of their resources and they perish. Now, a planet is admittedly far more complex than a tomato and fruit flies, but the principle holds. And what's happened with humanity on planet Earth is this. We've grown exponentially for thousands and thousands of years. We've now grown to the size of the planet. In fact, estimates of our overshoot range from, as I said, 30 to 50%. So we use 50%, roughly 40, 50% more stuff every year than the Earth can resupply and regenerate. So we're eating into the ecological assets or the ecological principle, you might say, of the planet. And the evidence of this, the aquifers are draining, the rivers are draining, the lakes are shrinking, the deserts are growing, the forests are shrinking, species diversity is collapsing, and the only thing that's still growing is humanity and human consumption. And we have to be able to look around and recognize that, you know, sustainability isn't if we all go out and buy a Prius. That doesn't make us all sustainable. We have to understand that simply tacking green onto everything we purchase and everything we buy isn't sustainability. Sustainability, when you're in overshoot, is reducing consumption. There's no other way.
That's so beautiful. Thank you so much. Now, you are also part of a movement here in BC to reduce our consumption. Talk a little bit about the Degrowth Conference.
Well, the degrowth movement is something that's happening worldwide, and if your listeners are interested, just Google degrowth, D-E-G-R-O-W-T-H, degrowth, and you'll see there was a major conference in Barcelona a couple of years ago. We're having our second conference in Vancouver next weekend, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of June, next weekend in Vancouver, for people who are around here. And essentially, the philosophy of the degrowth movement is this. When a species is in habitat overshoot, you cannot grow out of habitat overshoot. The only way to solve the problem of consuming too much stuff in your habitat is to consume less. So the idea that our economic system can continue to grow forever is delusional. And now some people talk about the possibility of decoupling or disconnecting growth from actual physical and energy consumption. The problem with that theory is there are no examples in human history or in natural history of growth that's decoupled from physical consumption. So we talk about our modern high-tech computer era that will use less stuff. It's not turned out that way at all. For example, remember computers were going to save paper? Never, ever happened. At the dawn of the computer age on Earth, we used about 50 million tons of paper a year. We now use 250 million tons a year. Computers have not saved paper. Computers, in fact, have created more uses for paper, and so we use more paper. The point is, technology, computers, memory chips, and so forth are not going to save us from the problem of consumption.
What inspires you to envision and create change? And see the change, the transformative change is possible.
Well, I think that what inspires me is just that I care about the truth. I care about what really is going on and really happening. I don't want to fool myself. I don't want to be one of the misinformed. And because I try to look for the truth, what I discover in our modern world is that we are not only destroying our habitat and diminishing our environment right now, but we're diminishing the potential for future civilizations, future societies, future human beings, and also every other creature that lives on the planet. We are limiting the potential for those people in the future, for our own progeny, for our own children and grandchildren. We are limiting their future by over-consuming today. And what motivates me? Goodness gracious, I'm surprised not everybody would be motivated by making the best possible future for our children and their children. And, you know, the idea of ignoring that, you know, for our own brief consumption, enjoyment of wasteful lifestyle just to me seems criminal. So I don't need to really look around for much motivation. I mean, my motivation is that, you know, everybody that's lived before me, I think, you know, people that have lived before us have worked hard to make the world a better place for us. And I think that's our job. That's the adult job. When you're a child, you're given a world and you're allowed to play in that world. When you become an adult, you have a bigger job, which is to look out for others, have compassion, be able to look into the future and try to make the world a better place. And I'm convinced that the only way to make the world a better place now involves the turning around or the 180-degree change in our conception that we make the world better simply by growing our economies and getting richer and richer and richer. Because why we've been doing that, we've been making the ecology poorer and poorer and poorer. So, in fact, our growth now, our economic growth now, has diminishing returns. As we try to grow economically now, we're making ourselves poorer. We have less fish per capita. We have less oil per capita. We have less forest per capita. We're reducing the species diversity. We're reducing wilderness and natural areas for people to enjoy and for other species to exist. So our growth is having diminishing returns, and it's making us poorer. So it's just common sense that we would change.
Thank you so much. That was so beautifully said. Rex Wyler is a writer, journalist, ecologist, and historian. He has several books. For information on his books, go to rexwyler.com. Thank you again for being with us.
Sylvia, thank you so much.
Take care.
Have a good day. Bye.
So just in closing, I want to remind people, if they're hearing this broadcast before the June 3rd and 4th weekend, and if they're able, they should check out the Degrowth Conference in Vancouver. But if you're hearing it after that date, or regardless of if you're able to attend the conference, you should check out the Degrowth website. It's an international movement and something that we should be paying attention to. And in closing, I'm going to play the song, "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised," as a tribute to Gil Scott-Heron, who just passed away in New York City last Friday at age 62. Thank you for your music and lifetime of activism. Gil Scott-Heron, "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised."
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother.
There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still lights of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the US. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.